I think this talk is called Like Swans That Leave the Lake. This is a verse from the Buddha. The mindful ones exert themselves. They are not attached to any home. Like swans that leave the lake, they leave home after home behind. I'm moving again. I'm in the process of moving house again. Now from Tacoma to Lakewood. I have moved so much in my life that I have to resort to quotes from the Buddha to feel okay about it. Gotten a lot of criticism. The astrologers will tell you it's not my fault. It was in the chart at the moment I was born. So what did the Buddha mean? Well, he was speaking on many levels, I'm certain, as he always did. But, of course, the monastics that followed him were homeless, and he was homeless. And the phrase that they use even now when you take robes is going forth into the homeless life. I've been a little reversed. I've been in the moving, leaving home after home behind life for so long. I'd like to go forth. Take the robes, sort of half there now. But for me, speaking from my experience, I can see the value of continually uprooting, moving on, changing, moving. Because then what has happened for me is I have to find what my real home is. And I find that my real home is the Dharma. And as long as I take the Dharma with me, I'm okay. So I encourage everyone to find that home in the Dharma, whether it's Dharma with a capital D in the widest sense, or even maybe, or not just even, maybe especially this present moment. It's the only one we have, you know, as Thich Nhat Hanh fond of saying, present moment, only moment. No matter how we try to work it, everything happens in just one moment, the same time, now. And the only place anything happens for any of us is here. Here, now. That's it. That's our home. So whatever is going on, whatever intensity is happening, there is one place that we can count on. We will always be here now. But the mind just wanders off endlessly and pretty crazily into worries about the future, memories of the past, regrets, guilt, just ping-ponging back and forth. What's going to happen if? What if? What if? What if? Oh no, oh no. But if in all of that, we can find the oasis of the here and the now, then we can ask, is it okay in this moment? Usually it is, even if we're going through difficulty. It's the mind's magnifying the difficulty over time. In our meditation technique, of course, if we're dealing with physical pain or boredom, the mind says, 40 minutes, I've got 40 minutes left. I'm never going to be able to survive for the next 40 minutes. So then that becomes the story. And that adds such stress and distress. But we don't have to survive for the next 40 minutes. We only have to get through the next moment. Or the technique, the instructions often are just this one breath. And that's what is meant by that. The instruction is very literal and very serious about that. There's never more than one breath. Did you ever try to breathe twice at the same time? I think lots of choking is involved. There's just one breath. So if we can begin to see how that helps us, we try so much, the mind tries to take on so much more than is possible. Walking meditation, just one step. That's all we have. Some of us, I am among the infamous Gemini folks, flying through life at 110 miles an hour. I used to, before the Dharma, with the capability of actually falling upstairs as you're going upstairs. Some people fall downstairs, but only those of us really accomplished in rushing can actually fall going upstairs. Because you have to slow down to go up or downstairs. Just one stair at a time. One step at a time. One breath at a time. And that is so helpful. It's a moment to rest. So the techniques we use are actually just so profound in so many ways. And one is to allow us rest. To take this moment and rest in it. We feel we're doing too much. We don't have time for a nap. We don't have time for... I've been moving. And my friend, I had a lot of people helping. I'm so grateful. And I was mentioning that every part of my body was aching. Just, you know how it does from moving, all that stuff. And my friend said... I said I was relying on aspirin, and she said, take a bath in Epsom salt. And I said, if I had time to take a bath in Epsom salt, I wouldn't need to take a bath in Epsom salt. Because it's just been every single moment trying to keep up my commitments and also get the moving and the cleaning of the old place. So... the thing that I kept taking refuge in is the practice itself, that actually all of this was happening in just one moment, one moment, one moment. And so I could keep resting, resting in this moment, even while moving. If you bring awareness to the moment, mindfulness to the moment, mindfulness is an amazing factor of mind. It has enormous implications as a mental factor. There's tremendous space a word you hear a lot, spaciousness. In a moment of mindfulness. Because it's outside of the perception of time. And the perception of time is not a happy thing. We created time. We didn't do ourselves a favor. I love thinking, I'm told the Aboriginal people in Australia, their perception of time is a bit more like our perception of distance. So something that happened a while ago would have happened far away, at a distance somehow. I don't know, just a different way. But mindfulness, awareness, putting attention there in the present moment just pops it out. Space and time are vast, and everything is pure and clear and at peace, but not necessarily at rest, because it's shot through completely with compassion. Like a blue sky full of sunlight. There isn't a place in a blue, blue sky without sunlight. Compassion lives in the emptiness of the awareness available to us in the present moment, like sunlight in a blue, blue sky. There's nothing else there, just vivid, bright, clear compassion, awareness, mindfulness, presence, and it goes on forever. And you can rest there. Why would the swans leave the lake? If I had wings, I would fly. How could you not go into that sky? The sky, like awareness, is vast and open. Before I started moving, I had taught two retreats this year back to back at Cloud Mountain, just because of some discombobulation with something or another. I was asked last year to teach a women's 3-day loving kindness retreat. Some people here were there. So I did the beginner's retreat weekend, Memorial Day weekend. The following weekend, 3-day loving kindness, and then the move. I hadn't known when I scheduled that I would be doing that, or I wouldn't have. But the moving situation arose without planning, and it was such a good situation. I couldn't turn it down. So the loving kindness weekend was a women's retreat weekend. And 3-day weekend at Cloud Mountain. I like to teach the beginner's weekend. I had asked them at Cloud Mountain if I could make this thing happen. Beginner's weekends, where beginners was in the title, because I knew over the years that there were a lot of people out there that weren't going to retreats and would never go to a retreat unless the word beginners was in the title. And I wanted to do that. And I'm particularly qualified to teach the beginner's retreats because I can teach the basics of meditation, but also I was on staff on retreats and at retreat centers as cook and housekeeper and manager and all kinds of things for many years. So I sort of have all this information that people need to start retreat on all different levels, from the ridiculous to the sublime, not just the sublime. There are many sublime teachers. I am also a ridiculous teacher. So I'm uniquely qualified for that beginner's retreat. And it was wonderful fun, but it was just short. So people wouldn't even have to take off work if they couldn't. But then the three-day other weekend retreats, as you know, at Cloud Mountain end on Monday, which is a bit of a stretch for me by myself because I sort of go full on. I just take it on 24/7. I can't not do that somehow. So so I did, and then I saw when we got there that the registration was 27, and which is a good number, but it's not full capacity. So then I thought, I might be able to give everyone an individual 10-minute interview. I might be able to do it. And I started playing with the numbers and the schedule and all of that, and I thought, well, if I just have lunch, don't take an after-lunch break, just start right away at lunch, start giving interviews. And if I have tea and don't take a break, just start giving interviews on the next day and all of that. So I figured I needed 270 minutes. So I decided I was going to do it because I really wanted to do it. Part of me knew it was too much, but it's nice if people who are beginning can get that experience if it's possible. You know, it's not possible at all at the bigger centers, and certainly not when it's full capacity, even at Cloud Mountain. So I did it and set it up. And by the second day, I was so both exhausted yet completely awake. I also wasn't sleeping very much. In the middle of the night, the rain started and woke me. On the roof, and so I was in a very bizarre, altered state, and I was checking with a few people I know. I said, am I making sense at all? I'm not just babbling. They said, no, it's good, it's good, you're making sense. So I was again reminded of that, how much it helps to be able to return to this moment vividly with clear, mindful awareness, to feel that spaciousness and to rest there as though you had a couple hours off, even though it's just a moment. So I really encourage you to see that returning to the breath sensations, the body sensations, whatever you're using as an anchor, or maybe some of you use open awareness itself. But whatever it is, let yourself feel that moment of returning to presence. Feel how that feels. Like, you see the ducks landing on the water, the swans landing on the water, or even those little insects that land on the water, and you can feel them touching that surface, and the surface receives them. And there's a feeling that we can get from while we're doing our meditation, even now, just returning to this moment. The sensations on the bottom of your seat or the bottom of your feet, that pressure sensation, bring your mind to that vividly aware of that pressure and rest it there. You feel that moment of attention landing in the present moment, awareness. Just for a moment, how peaceful that is, how alive it feels. We can do that again and again. That's one of the reasons we're practicing, so we get the habit of returning to this moment. But so often we emphasize the dislodging, the moment of renunciation, which is a good thing to emphasize. When we're lost in thought, in meditation, there's a moment when we wake up and realize we're lost in thought. Then there's this choice moment, because often what we're thinking about seems much more interesting to us than the breath. It's part of the reason I think that as meditators we get in the habit of chastising ourselves as though we shouldn't have been distracted, because we're used to motivating ourselves through that kind of pressure. And it may take a little bit of motivation to go back to the breath if the fantasy or whatever it was, or the planning, you know, this is the first time I've been able to sit quiet all day, I'm going to plan tomorrow's schedule, that's it. The heck with the breath. But that's, you know, we do that. But then there's a moment where we actually have to cultivate renunciation, even though we're not monastics. In our practice, renunciation is really strong. We see that, and we see the choice. We let go of thinking and move our attention back to what we're using as the anchoring sensations, the breath sensations, the body sensations. Maybe it's open awareness. Maybe it's hearing, whatever it is. So that's wonderful, but often for me, for years, that was an emphasis. But then I suddenly fell in love with the moment of rest, moment of return, that vivid presence, spacious, bright, clear, empty, like an oasis, a respite, the here and the now. A rest from all of that nonsense the mind is generating. Endless stories. Endless stories. Go on and on and on. I always forget who. The American humorist. Some of the worst things in my life never actually happened. Who said that? Mark Twain. Thank you. Some of the worst things in my life never actually happened. Right? The mind just goes on and on and on. So then to begin to see, ooh, renunciation can be a wonderful thing. And then we land in the here and the now, vivid present moment awareness. Rest. Rest. Rest here. So I had to do that a lot on that retreat. And so I was in this very odd state of being exhausted yet vividly awake. And then people coming for the interviews. And I remembered, I wish that I could have found for you the actual Ryokan poem that I'm going about to misquote. But since my household, everything is everywhere. It's, you know, you moved, you know how it is. I have no idea where the Ryokan poems are. They're, but I'm sure they're somewhere weird, in some box stuck. In any case, what I did was remember my first reading of this poem of Ryokan's. It's decades ago now, probably over 40 years. And what he said was something to the effect of, wishing that his monk's robe were wide enough to embrace all the suffering people in the floating world, something like that. He would say things like that. You know, he was called the Zen fool. And many of the things that he did after his enlightenment just involved playing with children. He'd just play with the children. But he also wrote poems and read poems and sometimes just wept. There's one verse where he's talking about being an old man, monk's robe wet with tears. And so this poem had that mood of wanting to embrace all those who were suffering, wishing that his robe was wide enough for that. And when I'd first read it, I loved it, but I know that I loved it with my head, you know, and a little bit of empathy and so forth. But it is such a privilege to teach meditation and to be on retreat with people, and then to meet people one by one in the interview situation and hear what people are going through in their lives and how much they're facing with dignity and open-heartedness and goodness and struggling and seeing, you know, if they can get some help, some support, some advice. And that's how I felt. The poem came back to me. And when we say with the appreciative joy, think of one thing that we're happily grateful for or about. I was just so happily grateful that what I had to offer was the Dharma, suggestions and practices and so forth. And I absolutely knew on my life that it works, that it can help. We all suffer because we were born. That's it. It's nobody's fault. It's in the teachings. There is this situation. There is birth. And because there is birth, there is lamentation. There is old age. There is sickness. There is death. That's the way it is. But luckily, happily grateful, there's also the path of Dharma, the teachings, the way of looking, the training ourselves to see more clearly so that wisdom can arise, so that there is less suffering in our lives, and so that we can reach out to others to offer some help and some comfort. There's that too. How wonderful. Oh, fortunate ones. In the Tibetan tradition, many of the teachings over the centuries begin with something that's translated, oh, fortunate ones. And the feeling is just to be able to hear, to sit, to study, and to practice the Dharma in this world is such good fortune. There really isn't any better fortune than that. Oh, fortunate ones. So I was so grateful to have some things to at least offer, to suggest, that I knew because of my good fortune to have spent my life in study and practice of the Dharma, that it was worth its weight in gold, as someone might say, worth its weight in gold. So both in my own experience that weekend of this strange mind state of vivid, alive exhaustion, and what the teachings and the practice did for that, for me, which was just another way of getting myself out of the way, right? It was like I had no energy for any of this stuff. I could only just rely on the Dharma coming through and training, you know, training and practice and the Dharma. If I tried to complicate it with my stuff, it would have been too much. It would have been tilt, you know. So that was a great lesson. That was really a great lesson. And then to have the privilege, the honor to have people come and share their amazing tenderness in their own lives, facing such difficulty. And this also allows us, allows me, and I know anyone else in this situation, to soften even more around what happens in the ordinary world. Everybody, what is that line? Kabir. Everyone is struggling. None of us has gone very far. So what that does is allow us to cultivate more and more compassion, more tender-hearted mercy toward ourselves, toward others. Things are hard. And yet people have such courage. So I'm really liking, I think I've mentioned here before and I'll mention again, this summarizing of our path as far as what we want to do with our practices that Mingyur Rinpoche does. Mingyur Rinpoche, the younger brother of my present Tibetan teacher, Sogni Rinpoche. And Mingyur Rinpoche is that young monk, one of the ones that the Dalai Lama asked if he would be willing to let the scientists fiddle around with his brain. So he's one of the ones that they put in the fMRI machine and changing the whole view of what the mind can do and what the heart can do, which is very, very exciting. He's very, very funny. He's sometimes at Nalanda West. I think this year, yeah, Sogni Rinpoche is going to be here at the end of July at Nalanda West, so Mingyur Rinpoche maybe will come the following year. But he does a very funny comedy routine about being put in that machine. He said it's really cold and they put you in horizontally and then they say things like, meditate on compassion for 3 minutes. Now stop. Now start again. Now stop. And yet, they had a, you know, control group, regular folks, and so they knew what the brain did, because you can, with the fMRI, I guess you can watch it while it's all happening. And then they had some regular folks who they trained some meditation, and they were very impressed. It was like 11 times stronger in the pleasure centers when the people had been trained in meditation and so forth. Then they put him in the machine. They thought the machine was broken. They called in the mechanics. They took the whole thing apart, put it back together again. Still the same results, like hundreds of times. His brain, meditating on compassion, just did these amazing things. And Then I guess one of the things that was particularly extraordinary to them, I think it must have been audio. Maybe getting this wrong, but must have been sounds of people in distress. But response was not anxiety or anything or fear. It was more compassion. It's just more compassion. So the volumes were huge. So they have to change their whole map of what the mind and the heart is capable of, which is quite wonderful, I think. Just really, really wonderful. But he's been very well trained, and you know, thousands of hours of that training to respond to distress with compassion. We can do it. It can be trained. I know from my own experience. I didn't used to be able to do that. It can be trained. So, Mingyi Rinpoche, in his most recent book, his first book, he talks about that fMRI stuff, if you are interested, find something with joy in it. And then the second book is called Joyful Wisdom. And that's more his talking about meditation and the Buddhist path. And then when he talks about the techniques, which Tibetan tradition particularly has massive amounts of techniques of all kinds, he pairs it down so nicely that we can just take it with us. He says, your path of practice, whatever techniques you use, you should at least have technique that settles the mind. And we're talking serious settling here. Not just relaxation, but really settling the mind, opening the heart, and cultivating wisdom. So you want to make sure you cover all of those in whatever practices you do on your path. Because otherwise, it's going to get lopsided. And having been, you know, it's like 45 years now for me in this path from in high school when there wasn't anything. There were no books. There were hardly any books. And then finally, Philip Kaplow, some of you with gray hair might remember, he wrote and published Three Pillars of Zen. And all over, those of us stumbled upon it somehow. I was in the suburbs, raised Catholic. I had to have my father take me to the next town with a bookstore. But anyway, we found it. If you want it, the Dharma will find you somehow. And what was wonderful about that book was it actually gave instructions on how to meditate. Before that, there was D.T. Suzuki's book, and there was the World Bible that covered Buddhism. But that was great, but didn't offer instruction. But Philip Kaplow's book offered, so we would teach ourselves to meditate. You know, now there's so much out there, books and audio and all of that. But back then, we were just on our own almost. But to find that, so then over the early decades, things were a little lopsided in American Buddhism, because there weren't a lot of teachers, and some of the teachings came back piecemeal, and we didn't have someone like Mingyi Rinpoche, or maybe we did. He's only 30, I think. I know who he was back then, but in any case, he was in Tibet back then. Yeah, he's the 12th somebody or another, so. So, a little bit lopsided, but now this notion, it's just a beautiful, simple way of thinking. Settle the mind, open the heart, and cultivate wisdom. And don't leave any of those things out. If your practice is to be a spiritual practice, if your path is to be a spiritual path, then we must settle the mind, because the mind is nuts, right? I mean, You know, in the old country, they talked about crazy monkey mind, and people who know the Asian cultures would know right away what that means. So we have to have, you know, like kindergartners on recess mind. You know, that's that kind of, some images like that that will let us know how wild the mind is. So we must settle it. We must train it with practices that will do that and cultivate the mental factor of concentration along with mindfulness. Mindfulness doesn't have much of a chance without some concentration. You've got to work with both of those. Find good techniques. Techniques in the Buddhist tradition, they've been used for hundreds of years. They always say simple, but not easy. Don't let the simplicity fool you. These have been tested by people with massive ability over hundreds of years. And if they didn't work, they would have changed them. This commitment to these, the wonderful, of course, Anapanasati Sutra, the scripture on the full awareness of breathing, that tells us that the whole path from the beginning to moments of enlightenment can be walked with breath practice. If you're interested in that, Larry Rosenberg's first book, Breath by Breath, explains that very clearly and beautifully in what modern Western language, how that is possible. So that's, you know, one of the core techniques. And there are others, of course. This room is full of people who know varieties of techniques, but need some serious time put in for settling the mind. It doesn't have to be completely and totally settled, and there's a wide range of people's abilities to concentrate. But what's wonderful is that this is the middle path, and it turns out it's middle in a lot of ways, that it's not, doesn't go to extremes. So it's not that we have to go to any extreme with concentration, but we need some, and the only way we get it is to practice. Just like if we were going to learn to play the piano or to learn how to golf. I always say that because you can imagine someone my height trying to learn how to golf. Golf and bowling. I once bowled a 00. I just couldn't hold it. It was like too heavy, you know? So, and golfing, this long, you know, I know they make them shorter, but I was just out there on the public place with those long. I should have just, it, like, you know, hacking at the bushes or something. I mean, it was not good. But even I could probably learn one of those things if I practiced enough. And of course, anyone here who's a musician will just tell you, if you ask, the hours that they spent. Not playing outside on sunny days, instead practicing. And of course, some people have great accomplishment, but it didn't happen overnight at all. So far from that. So we have to put in the time and the commitment. And then we must open the heart. And for us in the West, we must also heal the heart. I have mentioned to you before my teacher, Sokni Rinpoche, from Nepal, travels around the world teaching a lot. And over the years, he said he finally kind of understands, in the West in particular, that he is... We have stunning intelligence, great education, and we're all so interested in practicing, and he admires all of that. He said, but he sees now there's wounded love due to the situations of our conditioning and our culture and so forth, that there is a tremendous amount of wounded love. So we need to heal that. We need to have practices that help that heal, so that the heart can become strong again and then be able to reach out in compassion. You know, if your arm is broken, you're pretty much not going to be picking things up. You've got to put it in a splint, and then the body heals itself. Just think of that. I mean, what would our lives, what would we be like as we're so soft and fragile physically if it weren't the case that our bodies heal? They move toward healing if they can. If they've got the equipment, they do it. We have this amazing immune system. We have this repairing system. You know, you break a bone, you put it in a splint, and then it does it. If we can give it support, you know, the right nutrition and so forth, and if we don't keep trying to pick things up, it does that. I believe so strongly the heart does that, and the mind do that as well. They want to heal. They know how to heal. If we can give the right conditions, if we can give space and time, and these wonderful practices that we've learned and have been handed down to us through generations, give them a chance to work by doing them, by doing the practices. They do work. They will help our hearts heal and strengthen so that we can then reach out in compassionate activity. One of the metaphors for the Dharma is, or is it simile? Oh Lord, English majors, forgive me. I was only a minor. The Dharma has two wings, like a bird. That's a simile, I think, anyway. A bird can't fly unless both wings are strong. The wings of the Dharma are wisdom and compassion. So we must just see things as they are and understand that the heart needs healing, it needs opening, it needs strengthening. These practices are genius. They will do it, but we have to do the practices. And again, I always confess to the I would say the disease of the overeducated, one of the quirks of being so highly educated is one is under the impression that if one has read something and understood it, one has perhaps actually done it. This is incorrect. This is completely incorrect. We've all read books about Everest, right? But I don't know what percentage of the people in this room have climbed Everest, but it's probably very small. So, with the loving kindness practice, for example, you find this in Sharon's book and Sharon Salzberg's book, and also, in other sources. There is, in the Abhidhamma, they break this down, the mind stream and what causes what and what gives rise to what and da 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 da. It's just all meticulously laid out. And the cause that will give rise to feeling loving kindness is seeing goodness. So seeing goodness gives rise to loving kindness. So for example, in her book, she has an exercise where one would reflect on one's own good qualities. It's just make a list in your mind and your heart. Particularly if you're feeling very self-critical. One or two of us may have that difficulty. In the West, we sort of excel in self-judgment, self-criticism, and guilt, and shame, and blame, the whole thing. It's a part of our wounded heart, you know? So, actually, if we will do this as a practice, see your own goodness, just the everyday good things, make a list, particularly if you're feeling very down, very self-critical, and then you can notice your mood shifts right away. I'm not so bad. I fed the birds today. I'm not even going to tell you how many years it took me from reading that to actually doing it. I mean, really. We read those exercises. Oh, yeah, I know that. I get that. Sure, I got that. Give me a new book. You know, give me a new book. We always want another book, right? But to actually put it into practice when no one else was kind of guiding me, I wasn't, you know, in a group situation or anything. And then I thought, it works. Again, a little bit too much education there. I got it confused. I understood it for a long time before I actually did it. Do it. I give you my best advice. It works. And if there's someone, one person in a group was saying that doing the loving kindness, they, you know, you have your list, your dear ones, you know, and you got to get all your relatives. And someone said that there was one cousin that it just, maybe even the person who asked that question is here tonight, but every time they thought of this cousin, there was no juiciness anymore. So asked me what to do. And I said, well, I know a technique. What you do is you think of the good qualities. Because it's in the Abhidhamma, it's in the book. Goodness, seeing goodness, gives rise to loving kindness. So if we actually do that in a moment, again, we have to do it in a moment, and then another moment, and then another moment. We can't just know it, we can't just understand it. We have to do it, and we only have one moment to do it in, and that moment is now. So we do that. We think of goodness. We think of a good quality. And then maybe we think of another, and think of another. And then the heart begins to make the connection to that being again. So these things work. They are amazing techniques. Really amazing. Simple, but not easy. Not easy to remember. And sometimes not easy to believe, because shouldn't it be more complicated than that? Because our minds are kind of complicated. Kind of. Our minds are complicated. They're so complicated. I have said before, many of you know, my favorite word in the Pali language is papancha. And it means the tendency of the mind to proliferate endlessly. But lately I read a better translation. Complicated. The mind will complicate anything. And it will keep complicating things. Just for fun. Because the mind likes to do that. But complicated is not necessarily better. And simple and clear is what actually works. Complication is just kind of a sidetrack of the brain. Settle the mind, open the heart, cultivate wisdom. We have to have techniques. The practice, our mindfulness practice, cultivates wisdom because we actually begin to see things as they are. Our perception when not slowed down or speeded up, whatever you want to call it, when the mind isn't concentrated, our perception is incorrect. We don't see what causes what. We keep creating suffering, not because we want to suffer. Who would do that? And yet there's all this creation of suffering. I mean, there's enough ordinary suffering just by being born, right? But no, we add it. We add it. We go after things we want because we think if we get what we want, we'll stop suffering. This is what we think. This is what human beings think. We try to get rid of what we don't like because we think if we get rid of what we don't like, we'll stop suffering. Has that ever worked for the human race? Just look at history. Look at news. Look at the wealthy, wealthy people. They get anything they want. The only ones who aren't suffering are the ones who are giving it away as fast as they're getting it. But we have vast examples of the suffering that greed brings. It just brings more wanting. In the Abhidhamma, they say, you know, when you get something you want, you feel happy for a moment. Our mistake is we think we feel happy because we got what we wanted. But the teaching is no. We feel happy because we have a moment of not wanting. And a moment of not wanting is pure bliss with the habit of wanting, 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 endlessly wanting. So we can't see that at our normal rate of perception. So we keep bumbling along through history, trying to get rid of everyone we don't like and get everything we want. And it doesn't work. So we need practices and teachings to study as well. But the practices that will help us see, because once we really see it, I mean, if I'm sitting here and I happen to have placed this table on my foot, and then I'm looking out at you and I'm saying, I can't, you know, I'm having trouble concentrating, my foot hurts. I really can't. And someone says, well, Jude, the thing on, once I have that information, I would move the thing, right? Who wouldn't? You know, once we have the information of what our suffering, how it's actually being created, we will move. We will change. We will let go. So cultivating wisdom, we have to see clearly. So remember those, okay? Settle the mind, open the heart, cultivate wisdom. Settle the mind, open the heart, cultivate wisdom. And then find a true home in the teachings, in the Dharma, in your practice, so that whatever life does to you, whether it's self-inflicted, in my case, no one forces me, I just seem to keep moving and having to deal with it. Or I decided I wanted to give everyone interviews. You know, it wasn't the plan, or no one assigned that to me. I do that a lot. So, but whether it's self-inflicted or situations that the world brings, if in the midst of impermanence and the constant changes that we go through, if we have the home of the present moment and the habit and the ability to rest there, then we have a home we can go to in any moment. If we have a heart of compassion, then when we're suffering, we can also remember two things. One, that others are suffering in a similar way. The planet is so crowded now, you've got a few hundred thousand other folks, whatever it is. And so to think of them, we no longer feel so much alone in our difficulty. It's a real comfort. Maybe you noticed when we did the meditation, just to open it out and say, ah, there's a bunch of us going through this. May we all be free of suffering. And then to also know that at any moment, which is always now, on this planet, there are beings just dedicating maybe not 24/7, maybe 22/7. They don't sleep much. They just radiate loving kindness and compassion to all beings everywhere. And since we are a part, we are a subset of that set, we can sit for a moment and receive that loving kindness from those beings who are radiating it out at any time, day or night. So we can do that. We can develop wisdom that arises inside of us. We can develop compassion that reaches out. We can open to receive. And when the mind is wacky, we can settle it a bit. So let's sit together for a moment. At ease in the present moment, peaceful, spacious, shot through with the light of compassion. The mindful ones exert themselves. They are not attached to any home. Like swans that leave the lake, they leave home after home behind. Resting in our true home, in the here and the now. Thank you.